From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump goes to Alamo, Texas today to visit his border wall and tout his legacy. But in Washington, D.C., the House is debating how to remove him from power with just days left in his term. Lawmakers are expected to vote later today on a resolution calling on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment against Trump. More than 200 Democrats and a few Republicans appear to support the measure. But should Pence fail to act, House Democrats say they'll impeach him for a second time. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis joins us now. Sue, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And House Democrats are determined to make Trump pay for riling up his supporters before they stormed the Capitol building last week. Walk us through what will be happening today on Capitol Hill.
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's called the House back into session. Both chambers of Congress were scheduled to be adjourned until Inauguration Day. Essentially, today, they're going to start the first of a two-part process. The first part comes with a resolution by Congressman Jamie Raskin. He's a Democrat from Maryland and a constitutional lawyer that essentially calls on Vice President Mike Pence and the Trump cabinet to invoke a provision in the 25th Amendment that would essentially allow the vice president to become acting president through the inauguration. It's a longer process. The president could object to it. But in the short time that's left, it would have the effect of putting Pence in the office. We have no indication that Mike Pence is considering that. If anything, our reporting from my colleague Tamara Keith suggests quite the opposite, that there's no intention to do that. And this is a non-binding resolution. It has no force of law. But Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democrats have said that if Pence does not invoke the 25th Amendment, then they are going to move forward with another impeachment process against the president. And that process will begin tomorrow.
And catch us up, where do Republicans stand not only on today's vote with the resolution, but also tomorrow, potentially the impeachment article?
Well, you know, big picture, the president still has a ton of loyalty on Capitol Hill. And I think these are likely to fall closer to party line votes than not. However, Democrats do anticipate that they will be able to get more Republican support than they did the first time in impeachment when they got zero Republican support. Hmm. The president has seen a much stronger wave of criticism from within his own party following the events that played out last week and his role in it. We have seen some Republicans, people like Illinois Republican Adam Kinzinger, say that they support the 25th Amendment. We've had other Republicans, Tom Reed of New York, who's part of a big bipartisan caucus, say that they would prefer the president to resign or to look at other measures that could prevent him from running from office again. He supports a censure of the president. So it is quite possible that we could see more Republican support. But once you impeach, it goes to the Senate where there would be a trial, and it would take two-thirds of the Senate still to convict someone of wrongdoing. And we have no indication that there's that much support among Senate Republicans to vote in that way. But over there, we've also seen more voices criticize the president. Good example of that, conservative Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania basically called on Trump to resign from office and said he absolutely committed impeachable offenses.
The question of timing here is important because Joe Biden is expected to have the fewest number of cabinet nominees confirmed in decades when he takes office next week. And Biden has suggested that the Senate could split their attention between an impeachment trial and other business. Talk about that and whether or not Biden runs the risk of derailing his agenda in the first important months of his administration.
Yeah, this is really tricky. And it's why some Democrats and allies of Biden, like Majority Whip Jim Clyburn, said this week that he was advocating for a strategy where they could pass an impeachment resolution in the House and then just hold on to it, not send it to the Senate right away so as not to trigger that trial. It looks like they are Democrats are leaning towards not doing that. It's kind of conflicting to say on one hand this is a matter of urgent national need and then sit back and wait and sit on it for a couple months. We don't know exactly how the Senate's going to handle this. They're out of session until January 19th. It is possible that Democrats could get some cooperation with Republicans to move forward on things like cabinet nominees. But you would need a lot of consent and you'd need a lot of goodwill and you need Republicans on board and willing to do it. And we just don't know where the party is on that yet. The rules of the Senate require, again, for a Senate trial, that they must come into session at 1 o'clock every day, that all senators must be in their seats, and that the trial goes 6 days a week until it concludes. So if that is the case and Republicans aren't willing to sort of give some time breaks in there to confirm nominees, then yeah, it could really hamstring Joe Biden, especially in the early days and weeks of his administration.
NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
And now to Texas, where Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said yesterday, "We are in the middle of a storm." He was talking about his city's battle with coronavirus infections spreading, hospitalizations rising, and a positivity rate inching toward 18%. The city is urging residents to take precautions as it promises to increase vaccinations. So far, Houston has administered more than 14,000 doses. That doesn't, however, include doses being distributed by private hospitals like Houston Methodist, which received about 54,000. Dr. Mark Boom is CEO of the Houston Methodist System, where he's also a primary care physician. Dr. Boom, welcome back.
It's good to be with you.
So you've already administered almost 45,000 of the doses you received through the hospital, and we hear you're now vaccinating people in Category 1B. So who's included in that, and how does the delivery work in your hospitals?
Yes, that's correct. We've actually vaccinated almost 40,000 first doses and well over 10,000 second doses as of start of day today, so now just at 50,000 total doses administered. We decided to start with over 75-year-old individuals, recognizing that, you know, when you look at the entire spectrum of 1B, it's such a massive number. We wanted to get to the most vulnerable patients possible. We've already vaccinated more than 12,000 of those individuals. The rest of the vaccines we described are all healthcare workers, outside 1A workers, et cetera, and plan to do many, many more.
And your hospitals, of course, would be administering shots with some regularity anyway, but this has to be a completely different scale. So what kind of infrastructure did you have to put in place to get this done?
Yeah, this is not like anything we normally do. I mean, if you come to, for example, our main hospital, it's about 1,000-bed medical center. And if I go downstairs, our entire lobby now is basically vaccinating all of our employees for their second doses. And then our whole conference room infrastructure downstairs is where patients from outside are coming in. Now, we're going to pivot that over the next week to an off-site building because it has better parking and easier to do, particularly as we scale up. And then we're doing the same thing across our system at every one of our hospitals. This weekend, we're doing essentially a mega event on Saturday with 4,000 to 5,000 individuals will be vaccinated at one central site for Houston as well. That's part of our being one of the three hubs here in the greater Houston area.
So there's no doubt you're ramping up and you're getting vaccines into arms, but we have read about some problems. Some Houston Methodist patients, for example, who fit the criteria for getting the vaccine, say they've been unable to actually get it. One man told the Houston Chronicle, for example, that he scheduled an appointment online through a link that a friend had sent him, but that appointment was canceled. Another 75-year-old who also had a canceled appointment said he went anyway and actually got the vaccine after waiting for 2.5 hours. I realize these are anecdotes, but it sounds like there's a little element of luck involved in getting the vaccine. So how are you addressing that?
Well, you know, this is complicated. I mean, I think everybody needs to understand that. What happened was right after Christmas, we were sitting there advocating with the state to allow us to vaccinate people in 1B because we were not able to go fast enough just with 1A. And when they gave us the green light, we sent out a link, and that link went quickly viral. And some people, frankly, you know, outside of the age band who were scheduling shouldn't have done that. So we pulled a few of those off the schedule. But the reality is there is, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of times the demand as there is supply at the present time. We're doing our best to get everybody an appointment as quickly as they possibly can. But to put that in perspective, the entire city of Houston, the whole greater Houston area, is getting about 30,000 doses for first vaccinations this week. The population is 7.2 million people.
Besides asking people to sort of be patient and understand how difficult this process is, do you have some suggestions about how the system could get even better? Because we've heard some 36 state lawmakers sign a letter criticizing public health officials for a system that they say is kind of random and too confusing.
The first and foremost issue is we need to figure out how to get more supply to the states, because there are many institutions like ours who are able to ramp up far beyond where we are. The whole pharmacy infrastructure hasn't been tapped yet. We actually have a great process, great collaboration between all the Texas Medical Center hospitals, our city officials, our county officials, really looking at a community-wide vaccination plan. But again, the rate limiting factor is getting the vaccine in from the federal government into the state so that it can be distributed and we can go more quickly.
Before you go, Dr. Boom, I do want to ask you about a bonus that you've just unveiled. It's a thank you to your staff for coping with some very challenging circumstances. And also, as I understand it, it's an incentive to get them vaccinated. Tell us about that.
On New Year's Eve Day, we announced a $500 hope bonus, basically recognizing how tough these couple months through the winter are going to be. and wanting to give everybody something to look forward to. One of the criteria for that was needing to be vaccinated, because we believe that as healthcare workers, our sacred obligation is to protect our patients, and we do that best if we're all vaccinated. We also need to lead the way for the community. And if I look at my entire employee base, we're already now at 65% are vaccinated. Our physicians are 91-92% vaccinated at this point, and those numbers keep going up every day, which is great news.
And I can imagine that inspires some public confidence when patients see their own healthcare providers getting the vaccine themselves. That's Dr. Mark Boom. He's CEO of Houston Methodist Hospital. His hospital has vaccinated already about 50,000 people. Dr. Boom, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump today defended the speech he made to his supporters before they stormed the Capitol in a deadly spasm of violence last Wednesday. Before leaving on a trip to Texas, Trump said his speech was totally appropriate, though his words and the riot that followed launched an unprecedented second effort to remove him from office. Part of that effort is based on national security concerns. Last week, after the insurrection, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. Pelosi said she wanted to know how to prevent the president from launching a nuclear attack in his final days in office. Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst, and he is with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, it's good to have you back. Do you think that Nancy Pelosi's concerns are political or legitimate?
Well, I think they are legitimate. They may be political, too, but they are legitimate. Now, will Donald Trump launch a nuclear attack in the next 10 days? Probably not, in part precisely because of the events that took place this week at the Capitol in the aftermath. But the system, Peter, the system was designed for a president to act quickly and without impediment. And the ugly truth is that Mr. Trump could have launched a nuclear attack at any point in the previous 4 years. We're all sort of excited about it in the moment, but this could have happened at any point. And people who follow national security have known that he has been unfit to be president. And virtually every senior security official that worked for him and left repeated those warnings. And we, and myself included, sort of became numb to all the craziness, and we just sort of nodded our heads and moved on. But, you know, this time it was Donald Trump. Next time it could be someone else, a Democrat, the crazy leader of another country. It doesn't have to be in the U.S., but eventually you run out of luck. And so this danger is real. It's not getting better. But I fear that after January 21st, most folks are going to turn the page, set it aside, ignore our near miss with catastrophe, and sort of go back to business as usual.
So the answer to the question, could the military stop the president if he wanted to launch a nuclear strike, is essentially no. But Congress had tried and failed to pass legislation that would require the president to get congressional approval before he launched an attack. Do you think that that's something that Congress should pursue again?
Well, I think definitely Congress needs to pursue a different system. One not based on sole authority. You know, no one person has the right to destroy all life on Earth, to destroy a civilization. No one person, I don't care who it is, should have that right. Now, right under our system right now, which was designed during the Cold War so that it could respond very quickly in the face of a Soviet surprise attack, that system does not lead to caution. And so whether Congress gets a voice, or maybe the Secretary of Defense has to be consulted, or the Vice President, you know, someone other than one person should probably be in on the decision. And so that would be a change that's worth pursuing, but it's going to be very difficult. But let me remind you, when people talk about the military stepping in and stopping an attack, the president, he's the civilian commander in chief. The U.S., as of this week anyway, is still a democracy. And in a democracy, it's civilians, not the military, that make decisions to go to the war. And so we don't want a system that where the generals are deciding when war happens, but we need a different system where it's not simply the president who makes that decision.
Jim, I'm reflecting that over the years we've had you on this show many times, and almost always we're talking about international threats. The threat of international terrorism for the last two decades has been on our mind since 9/11. Do you think we just missed this threat that is within our own borders?
Well, I would say yes and no. If people read the reports issued by the FBI, Homeland Security, other agencies, it was pretty obvious that the rate of right-wing extremist violence, domestic right-wing extremist violence, has been increasing, not only increasing, but causing more deaths than foreign intervention, at least since 9/11, since foreign terrorist attacks. It's the domestic threat has grown larger and has surpassed the foreign terrorist threat. So, yes, people were aware of that. Now, has that, you know, there's a lot of people who don't want to believe that on purely political grounds. I know that from personal conversations. And has this sunk down to all the levels of law enforcement? It would seem that even though we've known it for a while, that has not sunk in.
It is just fascinating. The FBI, not really fascinating, terrible. The FBI has issued a warning about armed protests at all 50 state capitals and in Washington in the days leading up to the inauguration next week. We'll see if those states are ready. Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst with MIT's Security Studies Program. Thank you very much for your time, as always.
Thanks, Peter.
The economic downturn caused by the coronavirus pandemic is making the existing problem of hunger in America worse. The nonprofit organization Feeding America estimates 13 million more people experienced food insecurity in 2020 compared with 2018. And even with the new relief package from Congress, experts are warning that higher levels of hunger could continue for years. Molly Samuel from member station WABE reports on how some food banks are trying to meet the need in Atlanta.
A recurring scene around the country has been lines. Cars snake through parking lots turned into COVID testing sites. Families line up for help getting food on the table. Recently, there was one of those lines at a shopping center on Buford Highway, the main drag of a big immigrant community in suburban Atlanta.
There's always a line. If we say we're starting at 10, people start lining up at like 8:30 or 9.
Marco Palma is the president of Los Vecinos de Buford Highway. It's one of the organizations behind this food distribution event. Today, hundreds of people are here to get boxes of fresh vegetables and staples, oil, rice, beans, and tortillas. Many in this line are immigrants, families with kids. A DJ plays music for the crowd. Volunteers greet friends. Local high school students have set up an art show. Palma says Los Vecinos is a community organization that began 2020 envisioning get-togethers and encouraging people to fill out the census. But when the pandemic hit, they started working on rental assistance and food distribution, even though they aren't a food pantry.
We didn't really plan it this way. We had one in March and April, and then we just kept doing them.
Now they pass out food every month in different spots along Buford Highway. Yay! We Love Buhai is another community organization behind these events. Executive Director Lily Pabian says people here have been especially hard hit by the slowdown in business for restaurants and hotels.
These are communities that are frontline workers, right? They live pretty much paycheck to paycheck. They don't have the comfort of 401k, retirements, all that stuff. If they want to, you know, pay the bills, they got to work.
The pandemic is driving more people to look for food assistance in Georgia.
The food banks are responding to an unrelenting 50% increase in demand for food.
Dana Kraft is the executive director of the Georgia Food Bank Association. Her organization works with the food banks around the state. Kraft says about 40% of the people coming for help in Georgia now have never had to look for support before.
And they do not know how to navigate a social services network, and they don't know who to ask for help.
She says she's especially worried about families with kids. Her organization estimates 1 in 5 children in Georgia right now is experiencing food insecurity. She says the food banks she works with are helping people sign up for government support and supplying about 8 million more meals a month than they were pre-pandemic.
I couldn't be prouder of the food bank network in Georgia. I mean, they stepped up.
But what's happening at the food banks and all those long lines isn't the whole story of how the system to help hungry people works and how that system has adapted to the pandemic.
For every meal that our network distributes, SNAP provides 9.
SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, is the federal food stamp program, giving money every month to households to buy food. Beyond just serving a lot of people, it also lets people shop for the food they want rather than hoping the unpredictable food pantry offerings will be something they can use.
So SNAP is really the workhorse of the nutrition program.
And SNAP has also expanded here during the pandemic. Tom Rawlings is the director of the Georgia Division of Family and Children's Services. That's the state agency that manages the SNAP program.
So to give you an idea, in October of 2019, our SNAP program supported 637,000 households. In September of this year, it was 905,000 households.
That's a more than 40% increase. He says earlier in the pandemic, Congress allowed states to give some people more SNAP money per month. The recent relief bill allows a six-month increase in SNAP benefits and also sends more money and food to food banks. And Georgia is now allowing people to use SNAP to buy groceries online.
It's one thing to provide benefits to individuals who need food. It's another thing to make sure they're actually are able to use those benefits.
But not everyone's eligible for SNAP or feels comfortable applying for it. For instance, Gabriela Solis at the Buford Highway Food Distribution event.
You know, there's always rumors about how that affects your immigration status.
She's in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, for people who are undocumented who came to America as young children. This is her first time coming here for food. Before the pandemic, Solis worked at the daycare at her church.
But no more daycare, so now I disinfect the church.
Her hours have been cut, and she has a three-year-old son.
Especially during, like, rent week, you either pay the rent or either you buy groceries, so it's always that.
The nonprofit We Love Buhai, better known for things like collecting oral histories in the community, plans to feed 500 families every month for a year. Georgia agencies and the food banks say even with the new stimulus bill, they're preparing for at least 2 years of heightened need because the economy won't bounce back instantly, leaving nonprofits, food banks, and government agencies to keep filling the gap. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Samuel in Atlanta.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
Indonesian Navy divers have recovered one of the black boxes from the commercial plane that crashed into the Java Sea on Saturday. Investigators are hoping the flight data recorder will provide clues into why the Boeing 737 jet took a nosedive just minutes after taking off from Jakarta in heavy rain. All of the flight's 62 passengers are presumed dead. Here and Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan is following the latest into this investigation, and he joins us now. Seth, welcome.
Good to be here, Peter.
Sure, and divers are still searching for the plane's second black box. That's the recorder that captures pilots' conversations from the cockpit. So we could know more soon, but what do we know so far?
And what's complicating that just a bit is that there's a beacon that both of these boxes emit. It helps them find the boxes. That beacon separated from the voice recorder. But on the other hand, this plane did crash in shallow water. That's helpful. This is not, Peter, going to remain a long-term unsolved mystery like Malaysian Airlines 370. You've got a debris field. All of the pieces are close together. So one clue that gives is that this plane probably did not, let's say, explode. Then you'd have more of a scattered debris field. So easier right now to say what didn't happen than what did happen. As you said, the voice recorder, when they find that, that'll help too. Too early to say what might in fact have happened.
There are a lot of clues, including, as I said, that it was raining very heavily. But also, the Indonesian Transportation Ministry says the plane didn't fly for 9 months last year due to air travel being down during the pandemic. Do you think that could have played a role?
It's a possibility. U.S. airlines, other airlines around the world were very conscious about, you know, whatever planes were going to be flying again, that they weren't sort of permanently mothballing, keeping them in circulation even at a reduced level. So that's something that just hearing that alone, of course, we can't say was a likely cause, but that you would want to know more about what was happening with that airplane, how it was being maintained while it was grounded.
And another issue could be that pilots aren't flying nearly as much as usual because of the pandemic. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that too. And again, airlines around the world put programs in place to make sure that pilots remained active, remained in good practice, you might say. But that's something there too we'll want to learn more about, because no question, it's like anything else, except more critical for an airline pilot to remain in good practice and just keep their training current.
Right. Still early days of this investigation. Big picture, Seth. Since 1945, Indonesia has had the most civilian airliner accidents of any other country in Asia, including that 2018 Lion Air crash, which was the first of two involving the Boeing 737 MAX. What's going on? What's the problem in Indonesia?
Yeah, there was also Air Asia Indonesia back in 2014, another plane where everybody aboard died there. So you're right, a country with just a minuscule percentage of all the flights and all the seats and any way you can measure airlines in the world, with a number of notable crashes dating back to World War II, as you said, but also just during the past decade. This is three now we can name in less than 7 years. A country that has had its issues here and something obviously investigators from around the world are going to be looking at in terms of the country's status within the global aviation community.
Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Several Capitol Police officers have been suspended following last week's deadly riot by pro-Trump extremists at the U.S. Capitol building. More arrests are expected as federal authorities continue efforts to identify the rioters. More than 100 people have been arrested so far. Let's bring in NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas, who is following the investigation. And Ryan, the acting Capitol Police Chief has released a statement about the officers who've been suspended. What do we know about why they've been temporarily removed from duty?
Well, the acting chief said several of these Capitol Police officers have been suspended pending investigation. So the department is going through videos and other digital evidence to determine whether some of these folks violated Capitol Police policies during the attack. Congressman Tim Ryan, who leads a House subcommittee reviewing what happened last week, has said that two Capitol Police officers have been suspended thus far and another 10 to 15 are under investigation. So he gave those numbers. One of the officers who was suspended, we know, took a selfie with a rioter. The other one, Ryan said, was seen directing some of the rioters inside the Capitol the day of the attack.
And besides them, more than a dozen people have been charged already with federal crimes for their role in storming the Capitol. Who are they and what kind of charges are they facing?
Well, these folks come from all over the country. We've seen a lot of unlawful entry charges, disorderly conduct, some theft of government property charges as well. A couple of the people facing charges have drawn greater scrutiny, though, because of how they were dressed in tactical gear. Some of them had zip ties with them, and that has raised questions about whether some people who took part in this had advanced planning heading into the Capitol. One of those folks who has been charged is a man by the name of Larry Brock. He's from Texas. He's a retired Air Force officer. Another one is a Tennessee man, Eric Munchell, who investigators tracked down through some very tedious digital sleuthing work over the past couple of days.
We know there's a lot more of that going on because the FBI has received more than 70,000 tips in its investigation to identify people who were at the Capitol, so we can expect more to come. I also want to mention, though, Ryan, that two Capitol Police officers who were on duty during the insurrection have already died, one from physical injuries inflicted by the mob, but another by suicide in recent days. So what can you tell us about those officers, Ryan?
Right. The one officer was Brian Sicknick. He was badly injured by rioters while he was trying to defend the Capitol the day of the attack. He was transported to a local hospital here in D.C., where he died on Thursday night from his injuries. He was 42 years old. He was a military veteran, and he had been on the Capitol Police Force for 12 years. And then over the weekend, a 15-year veteran of the Capitol Police, Howard Liebengood, died. And an attorney for the family said that that was by suicide.
Yeah. Just a terrible legacy from a very sad day. Ryan Lucas, NPR Justice Correspondent. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, it has been nearly 19 years since the shocking murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. Pearl was in Pakistan reporting on Richard Reed when he was abducted. Reed was the man who tried to blow up a plane in December of 2001, just 3 months after the 9/11 terror attacks. Pearl's captors released a video of his beheading. There was an arrest and a conviction, but all these years later, the case is back before Pakistan's Supreme Court. NPR's Dia Hadid is here to explain. She's in Islamabad. Dia, welcome.
Hello.
And could you catch us up on this story? I think many people might not even be aware that the man who killed Daniel Pearl had been acquitted. Tell us more about who he is.
Yeah, sure. So his name is widely known as Omar Sheikh, and he's a British national with a history of militancy. Well before Daniel Pearl, he'd been convicted for the 1994 kidnappings of Western tourists in India, and he was released when militants hijacked an Indian plane to demand his freedom. He made his way to Afghanistan. It's believed there he connected with al-Qaeda, and at some point he filters back into Pakistan. Now it's there he comes into contact with Daniel Pearl. That's in 2002. Pearl was researching that story on connections between Pakistani militants and the so-called shoe bomber, and Sheikh built up a relationship with Pearl, and he lured him to the port city of Karachi. And it was there that Pearl was heading to an interview, and he was abducted. Now, soon after that, Sheikh was quickly arrested and found guilty of kidnapping and murder. He was given the death sentence, and three other people were convicted of kidnapping Pearl as well.
So it sounds pretty clear that he was involved, at least from those details. Why was his sentence overturned?
This is all pretty messy, but first of all, it appears that the original trial was rushed and it was clumsy. There was this big deep dive investigation into Pearl's murder by Georgetown University, and it found prosecutors used perjured evidence alongside a host of other mistakes. And then in 2007, there was this bombshell. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the self-described mastermind of 9/11, claimed that he personally killed Daniel Pearl. Now, he was never formally accused of this crime, and reports at the time said that's because he'd been waterboarded, which is a form of torture, so the confession might not hold up. But it was enough for Sheikh's lawyer to appeal his sentence. Now, it took 12 years for a provincial court to decide on this. Justice worked slowly in Pakistan. But then, in April last year, a judge overturned Sheikh's conviction for murder, and he said his guilt couldn't be proven beyond reasonable doubt.
Wow. So he's still in custody, and Pearl's family and the Pakistani government have appealed this acquittal. Is that also part of this Supreme Court hearing that's happening right now?
Yeah. So all of these are sort of like twists and turns stemming from that April ruling last year. So today the judges there began hearing from Omar Sheikh's lawyer. Now, we understand he'll remain in detention until the Supreme Court rules on this appeal. But bear with me here. This is despite a ruling from a different provincial court that Omar Sheikh should be released immediately.
All right. I guess the question is, how is the U.S. government reacting to this? It's happening during a very chaotic time in the United States, during a transition of power even. How do we expect the Biden administration to think about this case?
Right. Well, I mean, for the time being, in fact, the State Department has taken notice. And in fact, the acting Attorney General, Jeffrey A. Rosen, released a statement a few days ago saying that America was ready to take custody of Omar Sheikh to stand trial on the basis that he killed an American citizen. But we don't know how and when the Supreme Court will rule here, nor do we have any clarity on how the Biden administration will handle this going forward.
What can you tell us about Daniel Pearl, who was investigating the link, as we said, between Pakistani militants and Richard Reid, the shoe bomber? Richard Reid had tried to blow up a plane flying from Paris to Miami in December of 2001. Pearl was kidnapped, and there was this horrific video of his beheading. It was 19 years ago. Hard to believe at this point. Remind us how it resonated at the time.
Yeah, so it's hard to understate how shocking Daniel Pearl's murder was at the time, but it's also, in a way, hard to understand because it's been two decades since the war on terror began, and there's been so many brutal acts of violence since. But yeah. I was speaking to my colleague, Deb Amos from NPR, and she was in Pakistan at around that period of time, and she said it really shattered the innocence of journalists who worked here, and they'd been covering the Taliban and attacks and militancy. But it was the first time they'd seen anything like this. A journalist lured into a kidnapping and beheaded. And remember, that was partly at the time because he was Jewish. And, you know, this is tragic in many ways, but one of the ways that, you know, we can look back now and see is that Pearl's murder was a portent for everything that was going to happen after that. Al-Qaeda's gory videos of suicide bombings that they used to distribute in bazaars, and then ISIS that began producing these horrific made-for-TV beheadings and mass murders.
So what's the legacy? I mean, did his death have any impact on the war on terrorism or on U.S.-Pakistani relations?
This is an interesting one, because what Pearl's murder did was underscore how complicated Pakistan was as an American ally, because in many ways, you know, Pakistan did participate with the United States in the war on terror. And in fact, militants ravaged this country for years in punishment. But Sheikh's actions also underscored how deeply militants were operating within Pakistan itself. And there were rumors at the time that Omar Sheikh may have had connections to the country's powerful military intelligence agency, an agency that was accused and stands accused of supporting the Taliban. And it's one of those things that added to this sense of Pakistan being a double-dealing ally, and that sense has never really gone away for the United States.
NPR's Dia Hadid in Islamabad, thank you for helping us remember this important story. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Parler remains offline as it continues its court case against Amazon. The self-described free speech social network wants a judge to reverse Amazon Web Services' decision Saturday to stop hosting Parler, a move condemned by conservatives, but which Amazon said was necessary because of violent content on the site. And that follows a flurry of social media bans against President Trump in the wake of last week's storming of the Capitol. And it has added new urgency to a long-simmering question in tech: does deplatforming work? Let's bring in Elizabeth Dwoskin. She's Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad you could be here. And in addition to Parler's web hosting issues, Apple and Google have kicked the social network out of their respective app stores. Meanwhile, Twilio, Okta, and other tech companies have also stopped providing services to Parler. And yet Parler CEO John Matzy told Tucker Carlson on Fox News last night that he's not giving up.
We're going to be back online one day, and hopefully soon, and as soon as possible. But this is a real challenge. We have to build our own infrastructure, our own everything, in order to do it.
So, Elizabeth, can he do it, or is this the end of the road for Parler?
Well, I think they'll have a tough time, but if you look at the example of history, other far-right sites that have been deplatformed found a way to come back. I remember I first started covering this issue of deplatforming. It was in the wake of Charlottesville, the Charlottesville neo-Nazi rally, and I remember GoDaddy and PayPal delisted the Daily Stormer. GoDaddy's web hosting, PayPal payment processing, they delisted the Daily Stormer. And then a year later, there was the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And when it was found out that the man who committed those crimes was posting frequently on Gab, which another right, free speech, far right, friendly site, Gab was taken down by Microsoft, stopped hosting them. They were also banned by GoDaddy for web hosting and PayPal. But if you look at the example of Gab, Gab was started effectively, says now that it hosts its own servers. It found a GoDaddy alternative in a company called Epic, which EPIK, which has been willing to host a lot of far-right sites. And we just saw the news that Epic also said it's going to host Parler. And Parler also has funding from the Mercer family. So they probably have some money to do their own thing. And they have 12 million users as well. And if there are sites where they can still crowdfund, that's money that they can raise as well.
Sure. And the Mercer family also funded the Breitbart news site, as we know. And just to your point, I want to dig into this issue, Elizabeth, because I think it's really the key one. You mentioned Gab, which is now back online, says it has more visitors than ever before. And I'll just throw out one more. You know, 8chan, that sort of infamous seedy corner of the internet, has just changed its name to 8kun, found a new server, and lives on as an influential platform for conspiracy theories. So, I mean, is there any reason to believe that this time would be different for Parler?
I don't, but I think it's more, so I guess the fundamental question is, do these sites go down because these sites become forums for hate? And then the other question is, you know, after these horrible incidents of violence that, you know, that we've had in hate that we've had in our country in the last several years, There's all this call. There's this big call, as you can see, for lots of companies to say, well, how am I in some way responsible? And, you know, every institution should be asking itself, well, what did I do anything to contribute to this, to this kind of polarization and this kind of hate? And, you know, there's always this cycle where people are starting to turn to the internet companies that host this, because a lot of this conversation is happening on social media. And I think the sad truth about it is that you can't put Pandora back in the box. There will always be services that agree with the values and ideals, however hateful, of the companies that want to become forums for this kind of speech, and they will host them, and especially for political reasons as well. But I think that as they get smaller, you know, there are greater opportunities for law enforcement to surveil them as well. And they're weaker. I mean, Facebook has a lot of problems, but, you know, Sheryl Sandberg did say yesterday, the CEO of Facebook, she did say that, you know, the specific organizing for this rally did not happen on their service. And in fact, a lot of people did organize for the rally on Facebook, but they weren't saying the most possible vile things that we found on Facebook. So there is this opportunity for, as they go off of the bigger platforms, it's, you know, the FBI was able to find evidence of this. I mean, what's mostly sad in what happened last week is not that the evidence wasn't there or even findable. It's that the evidence was ignored leading into this riot. But it's not to say that they're going into the dark corners of the internet and no one can see them. In fact, it's a social media company and the FBI was watching.
And as you said, some of the planning was sort of out in the open, not only on these sort of fringe websites, but also mainstream ones like Facebook as well. That's Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Elizabeth, sorry, we have to leave it there. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. No problem.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.